This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Resisting the Boss, written by Whitney G. Performed by C.J. Bloom and August James. December 28th, 2012. Dear Journal, I just realized that the key to advertising can be summed up in one word. Bullshit. That's right. The key behind every single strategic slogan, even the greatest ones, Nike's Just Do It, McDonald's I'm Lovin' It, and L'Oreal's Because You're Worth It, is pure bullshit. It's all about making the customer think that those $100 tennis shoes work 10 times better than the $20 ones, even though they're made of the exact same materials. It's about making people believe that the Big Mac is the tastiest American sandwich, despite the fact that it's overprocessed, slightly dry, and full of pink slime. And last but not least, it's about making each and every woman think that putting on L'Oreal's latest nude lipstick and waterproof mascara will make her look like a million-dollar celebrity. As a marketing director at Statham Industries, the number one software company in the country, my team and I have the privilege of coming up with new bullshit every day. Everything our company produces, cell phones, laptops, advanced tablets, etc., needs a savvy slogan and a matching promotional campaign months before it can be officially released. My job is to make sure that only the best campaign ideas get sent up to the approval committee. So in all actuality, nothing should be sent up. Ever. All my associates are recent college graduates and future copy editors. God bless their poor, unfortunate souls. Some of them have potential, but the majority of them don't. Whenever I reject their proposals with pages of red-inked notes, they whine and say, "Can't you just give it a try? Can't you send it up anyway? I got an A in business marketing in college." As if that means a goddamn thing in the real world. These grade-A geniuses recently submitted the following taglines for Statham Industries' S-Phone, the iPhone's biggest competitor. S-Phone, because S comes after I. The new S-Phone, you so want it. S-Phone, because we can. See, this is the type of fuckery I have to listen to. With a straight face, for hours on end. To make matters worse, the CEO of the company, who never makes an appearance, sends out incessant memos about policies that don't make any sense. He recently implemented hourly parking zones in the parking lot to better enable employees to get home quickly and safely. But the real reason is to discourage overtime. Cars left in the lot after 5:15 are immediately towed away. How ridiculous is that? He also paid some idiot $2 million to speak to all company employees, an idiot who passed out beanbags and energizing packets to boost employee morale. We now have to attend weekly Zen sessions, monthly coming together focus groups, and spend 30 minutes a day writing in our Zen journal, i.e., you. Yes, believe it or not, you were almost tossed into the trash seconds ago, along with the rest of that useless Zen crap. However, something told me to reconsider that once I flip through your empty pages. I guess I can use you as a therapeutic device instead. I hate you, and I hate my pathetic excuse for a career. Claire. P.S. I promise I don't normally curse that much. On purpose. Chapter 1. Claire. My reflection was lying to me. She was showing me a happy woman in bright red lipstick and coral eyeshadow, a woman who looked like she'd just won the lottery, not a broken-hearted woman who'd spent the past 4 years trying to put her life back together. "You don't look your age. You don't look your age." I could practically pinpoint where my wrinkles would come in, where the creases near my eyes would multiply and spread out over time, where my lips would eventually thin out and dissolve into my mouth. So far, I'd been lucky, but I was pretty sure the hundreds of anti-aging and wrinkle prevention creams I'd been using were the real reason why. I was turning 40 in 2 weeks, and I was suffering from all the symptoms of a midlife crisis. I was questioning everything I'd ever done, comparing myself to all my friends, and wondering if I would ever find more fulfillments in life. I'd even started making a list of everything I needed to do once I hit the big 4-0. 1. Make a plan to quit my job in 5 years and pursue my dream career, interior design. 2. Pay off all my credit cards and start making larger mortgage payments on my house. 3. Stop reading so many romance books. 4. Save up enough to take my daughters on a week-long cruise in the summer. 5. Stop looking for potential wrinkle lines and quit considering Botox. 6. Clean my house from top to bottom and keep it clean. 7. Stop blaming myself for my ex-husband's affair. 8. Stop hating my ex-best friend for being part of the affair. 9. Treat myself to a new restaurant every month. 10. Learn to be happy alone.
Claire, let's go. We're going to be late,
my friend Sandra called from the kitchen. Coming, coming. I grabbed my jacket and headed downstairs. I took another glance at myself in the hallway mirror and cursed under my breath. I couldn't believe I'd agreed to let her drag me out to another singles mixer. I never found anyone worth my time at those things, and the foul scent of desperation always hung in the air.
You look stunning, Sandra tugged at my strapless black dress. Can I please borrow your wardrobe?
Only if I can borrow your life. She rolled her eyes and ignored my pessimism as usual.
Tonight is the night you'll meet the right guy. I can feel it.
She always says that. Do we really need to go to another one of these things, Sans? I have some marketing research I could...
On New Year's Eve? Are you out of your mind? We're going out.
What's the point? We've been to a ton of these things, and it's always the same. Can't we just stay in, drink some wine, and go over our resolutions?
Claire?
She walked over to my front door and opened it. We're going out. Now.
You don't have any work to do, and you know it. And it's your turn to drive. So let's go.
I stood in the winding buffet line and tossed a few veggie chips on my plate. I looked up at the banner that hung over the bar and sighed. It read, New Year's Middle-Aged Singles Mixer. Let's get jiggy. Aside from the tacky banner, the interior of Pacific Bay Lounge left a lot to be desired. Surfboards served as tabletops, old park benches were strewn about, and dingy blue and green streamers hung from the ceiling to simulate waves. Tonight, the lounge was way over capacity. Not a huge surprise, since lonely people seemed to flock to these types of events. I was so used to them that I'd become quite the people reader. The guy standing by the window was at least 60. The blonde hair dye he'd been using to look 20 years younger was beginning to fade. The woman who was dancing against the speakers was clearly going through a divorce. She was still wearing her wedding ring, and she'd toss back a shot every time the DJ yelled, "Cheers to all the single ladies!" I'd been there, done that. On the window seats that lined the far wall, shy women were fidgeting with their hair and clothes like nervous high school students. Most of them were being forced to be here, and had probably never had a fully functioning relationship in their lives. I grabbed 2 beers from the end of the table and sat on an empty couch, observing one man's poor attempt to get a shy woman to dance.
Is this seat taken?
A gorgeous man with gray eyes smiled at me, interrupting my fascinating people watch. No. No, it's not. Great. He sat down and put his beer on the table.
I'm Lance. What's your name?
Claire. Claire Grayson.
That's a pretty name. What do you do for a living, Claire?
I'm a marketing director for a software company. What do you do? He tapped the label on his beer.
I own and manage a beer company, Leyland Beers. It's in Nevada.
Very impressive, I said. So what do you...
How old are you? If you don't mind me asking.
Ugh. Here we go.
I'm 39. And yourself?
Wow. He looked me up and down. I'm 47. Do you have any kids?
I felt myself smiling. Two daughters? You?
No, I don't have any kids. Life's way too short for that. No offense. Can I call you sometime?
Seriously? Is that all it takes these days? Age, kids, phone number? Is the art of conversation that dead? Sure, I forced a smile.
Wait. How old are your kids? Are they with the babysitter tonight age, or are they secretly stealing beer out of your cabinet while you're gone age? I have to be frank with you because I'm not looking for anything serious. And all you women with kids tend to be more...
You know what? I stood up. I have to go to the restroom. I'll be right back. I pushed through the crowd and made my way to the outside deck, where lots of singles were watching the ripples of the Pacific Ocean swell up and down. I took a deep breath and inhaled the salty, wet air. The one thing I had yet to get used to since moving to the West Coast. I looked over my shoulder and saw Sandra talking to yet another guy, teasingly rubbing his shoulder and biting her lip. She caught me staring and motioned for me to come over. She was mouthing, "He has a friend." I turned around and rolled my eyes.
"I take it you're not having a good time,"
a husky voice said from beside me. I didn't even bother looking at him. I didn't want to engage in any more pointless conversations or mundane introductions. I just wanted to go home. I sighed. I'm 39. My birthday's in 2 weeks. I've been divorced for 4 years, and I have two teenage daughters. I didn't hear him say anything else. I turned to my left and saw that he was halfway across the deck. I took another swig of my beer and shook my head. I knew I wasn't helping myself by pushing every potential suitor away. But I couldn't help it. I still couldn't believe that I was actually single. My life had been picture-perfect years ago. 14-year marriage to a man who I thought loved me. Pretty Pittsburgh neighborhood in the suburbs. Amazing career that was almost on the brink of being legendary. But then one day it was over. Just like that. The priceless picture couldn't be put back together. It couldn't be saved. It was tattered, forever ruined, and I was the one who emerged with the most cuts. I sent Sandra a text and made a break for the parking lot, turning down numerous offers to dance on my way out.
"Hey, hey, hey!" Sandra climbed inside the truck and shut the door. "We've only been here 20 minutes. Don't you at least want to stay for the New Year's countdown?"
"No."
"Why? What's wrong? I saw the guy you were talking to in there. He was good-looking."
"Look, Sans, I'm not 20 anymore. I can't keep coming to these things expecting to meet the love of my life. I met mine already. Remember?" My voice cracked. "It didn't work out." I leaned back in my seat and forced a lump down my throat. The thought of losing my husband to my best friend still hurt to think about. The divorce was long over, but the pain still woke me up some nights, still dragged me out of my sleep and hit me over my heart like a 20-pound sledgehammer.
"You're thinking about Ryan and Amanda, huh?" She handed me a Kleenex. "You have to stop beating yourself up about it. It wasn't your fault."
"I was so blind to it," I began to cry. "I let her in my house. I trusted her with my kids. I trusted them both with everything."
"I'm so sorry, Claire."
My marriage to Ryan Hayes was a fairy tale. At least it was to me. Don't get me wrong, it wasn't entirely perfect. But we had far more amazing days than good days, more good days than average days, and hardly any bad days. Ryan was everything I ever wanted in a man. He was attentive and caring, thoughtful and compassionate, and he always remembered the little things that made me happy. Hot coffee on the rainy days I spent typing away in our home office, a warm blanket when I fell asleep in front of the fireplace, and endless chocolate chip cookies and candy bars whenever it was my time of the month. Every time he came home from work, he brought me a single red rose and kissed me like his life depended on it.
He treated me to the country club spa once a month while he volunteered to watch our daughters for the day. He even surprised me sometimes by beating me home and cooking dinner for all of us. He was my rock, my soul, my everything. I honestly thought our love would transcend time, that I was one of the lucky ones who would be able to truly uphold the "till death do us part" mantra. Yet, somewhere between the 13th and 14th year of our marriage, Ryan began to change. He started coming home later and later. He didn't leave his cell phone out like he normally did. He was extremely protective of it, and often took calls in another room. He was more elusive, vague, and any time I said that I needed to run to the store, he would jump up and volunteer to do it for me. At first, I figured that the late nights had something to do with his new promotion to partner at the law firm, that his recent clinginess to his cell phone was just him wanting to be alert should he receive an emergency client call. I couldn't figure out why he was volunteering to do every single grocery run, since he'd always loathed any type of shopping. But I took advantage of not having to do it myself. I chalked everything up to him wanting to be a super husband, and used my extra free time to hang out with my best friend since high school, Amanda. Amanda's vivacious personality could force the most sullen person to smile. Her voluminous auburn hair and naturally toned body could rival most teenagers, and her love for literature was as immense as mine. At age 35, she and her husband Barry were still attempting to have their first baby. They'd attempted everything short of hiring a surrogate, but they hadn't lost hope. With each in vitro fertilization treatment, I would bring her a new baby purchase, booties, bibs, collectible teddy bears, and assure her that the doctors were wrong, that she could and would bring a child into the world. So when she called me one afternoon with news that she was finally pregnant, I canceled my family barbecue and relocated our celebration to her and Barry's home. 6 months later, Barry called me while I was leaving work. He was talking so fast that I could only make out every other word. "Barry," I tried to sound calm, I can't understand you. Are you crying? Is something wrong with Amanda? Is she okay? Did something happen with the baby?
The baby, he said, and then he was quiet for a while.
The baby? The baby's not mine. It's not mine.
What? Barry, you're being ridiculous. You two have been trying to have a baby in every way possible for years. You're just nervous because he's almost here. You're going to be a great father, and
I was going back and forth to Texas in May. We might have had sex once during that month. Maybe.
I stilled. I remembered that. Amanda had been complaining about how little he was at home due to his job. He'd been demoted, and his company was making him do all the grunt work, denying his request to attend out-of-state meetings via video chat. I remembered her crying about how alone she felt, how she didn't think Barry was as serious about having a natural-born baby as she was, because he'd started talking about adoption. Still, I refused to believe that Amanda's baby wasn't his. Who else could it have belonged to? Barry, I think you're being paranoid. That one time could have been the time, you know? I think you should call and discuss this with her. I don't think I'm the right...
It's not mine, he groaned. Meet me at the Marriott around the corner from your job. I know you two are supposedly great friends, but I need to show you something.
Okay. I hung up and called Ryan.
Hey, baby, he whispered. I'm in a meeting. What's going on?
I need you to pick the girls up from dance practice today.
Okay, not a problem. Is something wrong?
No, I was about to tell him that Barry had called me crying about Amanda. But there was a strange voice in the back of my head telling me not to. I need to run a few errands, and I won't be able to pick them up on time. That's all.
Okay, babe. See you at dinner.
When I made it to the Marriott's lobby, I saw Barry hurling pennies into the wishing well, cursing at anyone who dared to stare at him. His eyes were swollen and bloodshot, and he reeked of stale cigarette smoke and alcohol. I tapped him on the shoulder, and he turned around in a rage. But then his eyes softened, and he hugged me tightly.
Thank God you're here. Come with me.
He motioned for me to follow him inside the hotel's upscale lounge and ordered a bottle of the most expensive champagne on the menu. Signed several times, he shook his head over and over.
I've never really liked wine, Claire.
He filled his glass until it slightly overflowed.
It was always Amanda's thing. I always thought it tasted like horse shit. The more expensive it is, the worse it tastes.
He's losing it. I knew I should have called Amanda on my way over here. I'll go call her in the restroom. Barry, I'm going to run to the...
She insisted on having this very brand at our wedding. Did you know that?
I shook my head. He took a large gulp and exhaled.
Yep. 1975 Chateau Trottinois. It's a Bordeaux, and it's still as disgusting as it was on the day I married her.
Barry,
that's why I find it quite fitting to drink now, especially since I'll be filing for a divorce in the morning.
What? I don't feel comfortable with you telling me this. I stood up. You need to go home and talk to...
My wife? My philandering, lying, doesn't give a shit about me wife?
I don't think so. He pulled an envelope from his breast pocket and slid it to me.
I hired someone weeks ago to follow her, to find out where the fuck she's been spending all her extra time.
I sat down and opened the envelope, flipping through the pictures. Amanda was shopping at a few boutiques, hanging out with me, and attending first-time mommy classes. I stopped flipping and put the stack down.
Okay, I need you to listen to me. I really don't think... I didn't believe it was true either. I mean, my guy would always come back with the same photos week after week. She was at home, at your house, out shopping. Pretty typical stuff on the surface, and I almost called him off the job. I thought I was being paranoid. But then one day at dinner I happened to ask her about you. I said, so, how is Claire liked being a freelance marketing director? Is it better than working for an ad agency? She said you hadn't worked at home for years, that you'd been working 60-hour weeks at Cole and Hillman downtown. So I asked myself, if Claire isn't at home during the day, who is Amanda going there to see? It can't be Claire's daughters. They're in school. So...
It took me several minutes to absorb what he was trying to imply. Several more to even wrap my head around such a ridiculous assertion. No. I shook my head. No! There's no way. There's a perfectly good explanation if... I picked up the packet of photos and flipped through them again. They were all circumstantial. Amanda's car parked outside my house. She loved my neighborhood's walking course, and often left her car in my driveway to do one of her thought walks. There were pictures of her walking along the hot metal bridge in the rain, sitting alone on a bench, probably crying about Barry not being at home again. But then there were pictures of Ryan, my Ryan, sitting next to her on that bench, kissing her on that bench. There were pictures of their cars parked outside the Hilton in Greentree, the next town over. Pictures of them walking through the city park hand in hand. Pictures of them having sex from the open windows of my bedroom. The date on this bedroom photo is yesterday. Barry lifted a photo from my hands.
I went to that Hilton myself. I followed them there in a cab. I waited 30 minutes before going inside and pretended to be her brother, who happened to get lost on the way. I walked over to the front desk clerk and said, "My sister is always bragging about how nice this place is, how often she uses it for a getaway. You must see her a lot, huh? You want to know what that clerk said to me?"
"No." Tears fell down my face. He took another gulp of his wine.
"I'll tell you anyway." He said, in the most annoyingly excited salesman voice, "Oh, yeah. She's been coming here off and on for over a year. She tips every time she comes, and she just loves our room service menu."
For over a year.
Right under my goddamn nose.
His face reddened, and he shook his head.
I wanted to go up there and confront them, but I knew I would have killed them, both of them.
I can't pretend that I don't know anymore, Claire. I can't pretend to be happy about a baby that's not mine. And when I got this last set of pictures today, I made up my mind. I've hired a lawyer and I'm telling her it's over tonight. I just thought I would let you know the real reason why before she lied to you like she lied to me.
He banged his fist on the table. I looked through the photos once more, hoping that my eyes were playing tricks on me, that it wasn't really my best friend and my husband in the shots, praying that I was in some type of sick nightmare. But the images never changed. It was true.
Cheers to faithful spouses!
Barry poured another glass of wine and practically forced me to drink it. That wine was disgusting, but not as disgusting as the following weeks would be.
It's okay, Claire. Sandra motioned for me to switch seats with her. Let's go home.
Chapter 1.5 Claire. The summer my divorce was finalized, I wasn't sure what to do with my life. Everything I'd ever known, everything I ever was all entwined with Ryan. He was a huge part of me, an ingrained piece of my identity, and I didn't know who the hell I was without him. I wanted to do the whole eat, pray, love thing, you know, travel the world, and try to find myself while tasting new foods, soaking up new cultures, and having reckless sex with a young, hot Brazilian. But I knew that was completely unrealistic. I was in serious debt. I was terrified of planes. And too much time without my daughters would have driven me insane. So, instead, I opted for long walks in the park. Walks that usually ended with me curled up against a rock, sobbing until my sides ached. No matter how hard I tried pretending to be fine, there was always something that triggered a miserable memory of my failed marriage. A young couple playing with their children in the park. A flower stand vendor offering discounts on red roses. A group of college kids wearing their University of Pittsburgh t-shirts. I tried reading books about divorcees who overcame their pain, hoping to feel inspired or enlightened. But they only made me feel more depressed. I tried hanging out with my other friends, thinking they would distract me from my agony. But they were more interested in throwing pity parties. After months and months of non-stop bawling, I decided to attack my heartache in stages. Well, phases, if you will. There was the Dr. Phil and mint chocolate chip ice cream phase, where I sat up and watched the good doctor rip cheating spouses to shreds. I recorded each and every episode and watched them over and over. I even imitated the twang in his voice as he said, "Why would you do that?" And I rewarded myself an extra scoop each time I didn't yell, "Liar!" when the cheating spouse tried to justify himself. There was the recent divorcee group phase, where I tried to connect with other hurt women at a local church. It was kind of like Alcoholics Anonymous, but shockingly more depressing. None of the women could get two sentences out without sobbing, and by the time it was my turn, I was too numb to speak. I was planning to end this phase after a few weeks, but after one particular meeting, the lead advisor asked me not to come back. She said she noticed that every time I was asked to give a suggestion about an ex-husband to a grieving divorcee, I always said, "You should have him murdered." I assumed the deadpan tone of my voice and the seriousness in my eyes prevented them from seeing that I was joking. I even went through an "I am woman, hear me roar" phase, where I made the following drastic decisions. 1. Cut my waist-length hair to barely shoulder-length. 2. Picked up a new habit, smoking, which lasted all of one day. 3. Got a tattoo of my freedom date, the date of my divorce, on my foot, pierced my ears, and actually accepted the shop's complimentary belly button piercing. 4. Blasted female power anthems whenever I was in my car, in my work office, or at home cleaning. I'm pretty sure my daughters trashed and burned my Shania Twain CD. 5. Sold all my worldly possessions, except my TV,
and my e-reader, and my iPod, and my... Okay, so I just gave away everything that belonged to Ryan. As I was testing out all these phases, my career as senior marketing chair for Cole and Hillman Associates continued to suffer miserably. Our newest client's product was named Infidelity, and the company insisted on using the phrase, "Some vows were made to be broken," as the tagline. It wasn't until I spent an entire day crying in a public restroom that I realized what I had to do. I had to leave. I had to start moving on. I quit my job, withdrew my daughters from school, and packed up my SUV. I used what little settlement money I received from my divorce and made the cross-country drive from Pittsburgh to my mom's hometown of San Francisco, California. I bought a small fixer-upper in a quaint neighborhood, a house at the very top of a slope. I watched numerous HGTV shows and completed several home improvement projects as my therapy. As a way to keep my mind busy, I stripped all the carpeting and installed hardwood and sleek ceramic tile. I painted each and every room, soft taupe, creamless ivory, cafe au lait, woodsy red. Within 3 months of moving, I'd had numerous job interviews, but very few callbacks. After realizing that my options were limited in the recession, I reluctantly took a mid-level marketing job at Statham Industries, a huge downgrade in pay cut from my previous position. I told myself that less money wasn't necessarily a bad thing. It was a new thing, and I needed to do more new things in order to truly move on. Since I'd never been a fan of running, I woke up early every morning and forced myself to run, half a mile at first, then a full mile, and then eventually 3 miles a day. I had my hair chopped even shorter, from shoulder length to bob length. I started treating myself to a day at the salon twice a month, something I'd always dreamed of doing but never found the time to do. I even shopped for a whole new wardrobe, trading in my trademark all-black outfits for colorful silk blouses, pencil skirts, flattering dresses, and well-fitted suits. One day while I was out shopping, I met a woman named Sandra Reed. She was one of those people with a mild-mannered yet upbeat personality. Someone I felt like I could instantly trust, like I could tell anything to. I was pretty sure her career as a psychiatrist had something to do with that. When I opened up months later and told her the real reason why I'd fled to San Francisco, she insisted that I start going to therapy. Out of respect for our budding friendship, she recommended me to one of her firm's renowned associates and wrote off my sessions for free. She always encouraged me to go out, to try finding men at singles mixers, and to actually attempt dating again. Yet after 4 years of being in San Francisco, I still couldn't bring myself to do it. I didn't believe too many men would be interested in a middle-aged divorcee, and doubted that any man would be able to heal the wounds inflicted by Ryan and Amanda.
Chapter 2. Jonathan. Jesus, she's sexy. I was at a business dinner with some associates when I spotted a gorgeous redhead looking out over the deck of Pacific Bay Lounge. She was absolutely stunning. The short black lace dress she was wearing hugged her curvy body in all the right places, and I was straining to see what was underneath that plunging neckline. Her glossy hair was swept to the side in loose curls that barely touched her shoulder, and her eyes, soft green eyes, were glimmering against the twinkling lights that hung above her head. "Mr. Statham?" my executive lawyer interrupted my thoughts. "When do you want to go over that proposal?" "Tuesday morning. I have a feeling it's going to take a long time to sort through everything. I can't believe they don't want a merger. They're going to lose a lot of money with a buyout." He shrugged his shoulders. "I can't believe it either, but it might be a power play to test your commitment. I'll see you Tuesday." "Me too. Have a good New Year's. See you at corporate." The rest of the associates shook my hand and walked away. I turned back around to get another look at the red-haired goddess, but I didn't see her anymore. Was I dreaming? How much did I drink tonight? I scanned the pier again, and There she was. She'd moved several feet down. I watched her sip her beer and sigh, wondering if she was attending that party alone.
I think that went pretty well,
my trust advisor Vanessa smiled. You're a great conversationalist. It's a win-win for Statham Industries either way. Don't thank me yet. We still have to get them to close on it. I stood up. Thank you for coming tonight. I couldn't have done it without you.
You're leaving?
Don't you want to stay and have a few drinks with me?
It is New Year's Eve, and I don't have anybody to kiss after the countdown.
Vanessa, we've been through this. You know I don't date employees. She rolled her eyes.
I'm not a regular employee. I'm a chair on the board.
Even worse. Yeah, well, mixing business with pleasure, it's more than a cliche. Besides, I don't want things getting complicated between us.
They won't get complicated.
She reached up and touched my face.
You and I would be perfect together, and you know it.
I sighed. Vanessa and I did have good chemistry, and we'd come close to kissing in my office several times over the past year. But I always broke away. Even though she was extremely beautiful, curly coffee brown hair, ocean blue eyes, and an amazing body, there was something missing, and I wasn't quite sure what that was. Maybe it's nothing. Maybe I should give us a chance after all. We are really compatible, and... Out of the corner of my eye, I saw the redhead moving down the pier again. I'll see you at the next meeting, Vanessa. I pushed my way past the cafe tables and looked back over my shoulder every few seconds, making sure the redhead was still there. I rushed over to the front doors of Pacific Bay Lounge and made my way inside. I looked around the room and stopped. There was a banner with the word Jiggy on it. There were little napkins on the tables that read, Cheers to the first middle-aged mixer of 2013. The majority of the people in the room were clearly in their 40s and 50s. Some of them were even wearing party hats with their ages written on them in glitter. There were a few younger people scattered about, but those people were holding serving trays or cleaning off tables. There's no way the woman I saw was middle-aged. I made my way out to the pier and looked around. I leaned on the railing and looked both ways. She wasn't there. I walked back and forth along the deck, aimlessly searching, trying to find her. I went back inside and waded through the crowd, but she was nowhere to be found.
Hello there.
A woman's hand landed on my shoulder, making me turn around.
What brings you out tonight? She purred.
She was an extremely attractive older woman. I guessed at least 50 years old, and I could tell by the way she was looking at me that she was the assertive type. Good evening, I smiled. I just came in looking for someone particular.
She's right in front of you.
She rubbed her hand across my chest and batted her eyes. Oh, God.
You wouldn't be here if you weren't interested in older women.
She reached up and playfully ran her fingers through my hair.
Those young girls don't know how to treat a man right, do they? But I do. We should get out of here before someone tries to steal you away from me. My place?
I started to say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. But my breath caught in my throat once I felt her hand sliding down my pants. I gently grabbed her hand and moved it away. I'm not here looking for... I don't. I was really here looking for someone else.
Oh my God, I'm sorry, she gasped. I thought... I'm so sorry.
She looked embarrassed. If it's any consolation, I said as I adjusted my pants, you're very attractive, and I'm sure you'll find the right guy soon. Before she could reply, I turned around and bolted out of there. I walked into the security director's office and shut the door. You're here on time, my best friend Corey rolled his eyes. What am I supposed to be doing for you again? Stalking some woman you met? It's not stalking. Whatever you call it, it's highly illegal. But since you said it was love at first sight, I guess I can make an exception. First of all, it's not love. Second of all, I don't even know who she is.
So, why am I hacking into the security footage of Pacific Bay Lounge at 7 in the morning?
I sighed. Because you're my best friend and an employee. Don't act like this is against your morals or something, Corey. You do this all the time.
I do, huh? He laughed. What's the time frame?
New Year's Eve between 11:30 and midnight. He began typing away at his keyboard, and the 20 massive screens that covered his office wall began to illuminate in grids and static.
Wait, you are having a business dinner that late at night? Since when do you agree to those?
Since the client is worth $500 million. My eyes focused on the screens that were now showing people walking in and out of the lounge. She was wearing a short black dress. Is there any way you could color code this thing by clothes or search for people by their hair color? She's a redhead. He looked at me and raised his eyebrow.
You said you saw her on the pier, right?
I'll just tap into those cameras. Give me a second. They have some pretty outdated software. And surprise, there's no audio, only visual. The screen started to show the pier action in slow motion. People were lounging on couches, drinking beers, and dancing next to the speakers.
Wait, I stepped closer to the screens. That's her. Pause it.
The images suddenly froze, and I looked the woman over again. She was walking out onto the deck with a beer in her hand, slightly pursing her plump pink lips. From the angle of the cameras, I could see that her fitted black dress cut right above the top of her thighs and gave way to a set of perfectly toned legs. She was even sexier than I remembered.
I'd probably waste company resources trying to find her, too, Corey nodded his head in approval.
You said she was 50? She looks pretty damn good to be 50. I say go for it. I would.
What?
I'm not sure how old she is. She can't be much older than me, though. He pressed play on the video again and paused it when she leaned over the railing.
She has C cups, not bad.
How old are you again?
It's a habit. If I had to guess, I would say she's 30 or a tad bit younger. Any older than that, and she knows where the fountain of youth is hidden. Actually, now that I think about it, I meant to tell you that there was an article about...
Please, not today, I shook my head. You need to stop reading those conspiracy books. There's no such thing as the fountain of youth.
Really? Well, explain Johnny Depp.
He crossed his arms. I rolled my eyes.
Exactly. If I wasn't making so much money working for you, I'd be out there trying to find it myself.
Good to know. Is there any way you could access the cameras in the parking lot? I need to get her license plate number and...
And what?
Show up to her house and say, Hey, I tried to find you at the lounge the other night, but you were already gone. But don't worry. I had my friend hack the security system so I could get your tags to get your address and come ask you out.
Seriously?
I wouldn't say it exactly like that, but...
Forget it. All the street cameras are managed and monitored through FlynnTech, and they're impossible to hack. Trust me, I've tried it.
So, what do you suggest I do?
Move on?
He turned off the screens.
You don't even know her name. Yeah, she's beautiful, but there are plenty of other beautiful women out there. I'm sure you, of all people, can find another one in a heartbeat.
Speaking of which, why don't you give Vanessa a chance?
She has no baggage. She's insanely hot, and she practically loves you already.
She's an employee. It's against company policy. I specifically ordered that a no fraternization clause be included when I started this company. Remember?
He rolled his eyes.
Whatever. You can find yourself another pretty redhead. That was true, but I'd never thought about a woman after meeting her for the first time. It usually took a couple dates or a few lengthy phone calls to keep a woman on my mind. But I hadn't even met this woman yet. I'd also never asked Corey to find footage of someone I was interested in before. I'd never been that intrigued. I pulled into a grocery store parking lot and sighed. Thanks to a dry cleaning mix-up, I was wearing a sweatshirt and jeans and would have to run home to get another suit. I was supposed to be at a board meeting in an hour, but I honestly didn't feel like going. I felt like driving back home, turning off all my phones, and pretending like I wasn't the CEO for the rest of the day. Anytime I felt this way, I had to force myself to revisit painful memories of my past, memories that made me realize that I needed to be grateful for all that I had, that I could still be wandering around in a trailer park going through people's trash cans, begging disabled neighbors for their leftovers. Still, sometimes that wasn't enough. I was starting to hate my company and all the obligations that came with it. For the past few months, the board had been pressuring me to lay off thousands of low-level employees. They swore it would save us millions, but I didn't want to do that. If I was going to fire anyone to save money, I would lay off the people that made the most money, the senior-level executives that spent more time on the golf course than they did at their desks. As a matter of fact, ever since I made the decision to relocate company headquarters from New York City to San Francisco 6 years ago, the board members had questioned my every decision, as if I hadn't started the company myself, without their help. If their past donations hadn't helped me grow my first software company from a side job in college to a billion-dollar empire within a decade, I would have written them off years ago. Why did I ever bother becoming the CEO? Why didn't I just sell the company once I dropped out of college? My cell phone started to ring, an Ohio number, Allen Correctional Institution. I debated whether or not I should answer it, letting the full chorus of Coldplay's Clocks play before picking it up. "Father," I answered. "Jonathan, how are you, son?" "I'm fine. And how's your company?" "Great." "You don't have to be so short with me all the time. I was just calling because I haven't heard from you in a while. I wanted to say thank you for putting all that money on my books last week." He paused. "I stocked up on honey buns and blue shampoo. Are you going to your mother's graduation?" "I always go to her graduations. She seems to graduate every year." He sighed. "She's going to stay clean this time. She promised me." "Okay, I believe you," I said like I had several times before. "I meant what I said last month. I want to be part of your life again, Jonathan. I know I wasn't the best father, but I've always been very proud of you, and I want to do whatever I can to fix our relationship." This call is currently being monitored and recorded by the Ohio Department of Rehabilitation and Corrections. There are 30 seconds left on the call. The all-too-familiar automated voice droned on the line. "Okay," I sighed. "Well, I'll do my best to remember that. I'll send you a letter this week, and don't forget that I promised to take you out for a beer in 6 years. Hope you're still looking forward to that." "I am. I'll hold you to that, son." "Goodbye," I hung up. I knew I should have been more enthusiastic about his phone call, or about my mother completing drug rehab. But the excitement tended to wane after someone relapsed 12 times. After someone disappointed you so much that you no longer believed in them. I tried to shake the thought of my messed up parents out of my mind and revved up my car. I was about to hit the gas in reverse, but I suddenly heard the jangling of a grocery cart from behind. I sighed and looked in my rearview mirror, prepared to honk at whoever was there, but I saw that it was the beautiful woman I'd seen days ago. She was wearing a dark gray pencil skirt and a pink silk blouse, but her hair was different today. It was bone straight, and the wind seemed to enjoy tossing it as she walked. She pushed her cart past my car without looking my way, but I still caught a glimpse of her gorgeous green eyes. I watched her walk inside and turned off my car. Before I could step out, my phone rang again. Oasis Drug and Rehabilitation Center. My mother. So much for not thinking about the past today. Chapter 2.5. Jonathan. Summer 2002. It was raining. Hard. Streaks of lightning were dancing across the sky, and rain bullets were beating across my window pane. As I looked outside, I saw the reflections of my miserable life in the downpour. Both my parents were denied an early release from prison. My little sister had been sent to live with yet another foster family. And my own terrible excuse for a foster family was trying their hardest to convince me to stay in state for college, They knew that if I stayed, they would get a bonus check from the Children's Welfare Office for successfully raising a child who remained in state for college. I knew that my life was bound to be terrible if I spent any more time in the hellhole that was Ohio, so that night I made a plan to get out. I told my foster parents that I'd decided to go to the University of Dayton, and that right after my graduation ceremony, I wanted to go to a nice restaurant and celebrate. The greedy look in their eyes almost made me hurl on the spot, but I kept playing the part. I smiled and told them I was grateful for all they'd done for me over the years. I just left out the part about them hijacking my parents' prison letters, taking me clothes shopping at Goodwill while their biological kids were allowed to shop at real stores, and reminding me day in and day out that I would end up just like my parents one day, a cracked-out meth head who deserved to rot behind bars. When the day of my graduation came, I set my well-thought-out plan in motion. I stuffed my best pants and shirts into a backpack. $500 I'd made from secretly doing college kids' computer science homework, and a few essentials for a life on the run. "What's the backpack for?" My foster mother Luann walked into my room. "It's my outfit I'm going to wear after the ceremony. I want to dress more casual at dinner." "Oh, of course. No one wants to get their fancy suit dirty at dinner." She adjusted my tie. "It's too bad you weren't born into this family. We could have bought you a better suit. But you know how it is. The state only gives us enough money to feed you, not clothe you." I tried not to flinch as she ran a lint brush against my shoulders. "Your high school graduation is going to be the highlight of your life," she sighed. "You probably won't last that long in college, but don't worry. Neither me nor Bob expect you to." "Thank you very much." I still can't imagine what it must have been like to have meth dealers as parents. It must have been awful. "I think about it every day, and I feel so bad for you." She stepped back to look at me. "But then I say to myself, Luann, thank God you saved that boy. Even if it is only temporary, and he becomes a druggie just like his pitiful parents, at least he'll have some fond memories to look back on while he sits in prison," she smiled. "I'm going to get my camera." She left, and I thought about jumping out the window right then and there, but I knew that was futile. We lived in the middle of nowhere, and I needed the family car to get me into the city. My foster brother Corey walked into the room and shut the door behind him. He crossed his arms and stared at me for a long time. I was tempted to tell him that today would be the last day I would ever see him, but I couldn't bring myself to do it. He and I had actually become great friends, despite his parents' treatment of me. And if I wasn't so broken on the inside, I would have stayed a little longer, just for him and his little sister. "I'm sorry about my parents," he sighed. "But I want you to know that I really liked having a brother, a lot. Are you going to forget all about me and Jessica when you leave and start over? I can't blame you if you say yes." "What are you talking about? I'm not..." "Don't worry." He picked up my backpack and stuffed a brown paper bag inside. "I'm not going to tell my parents. I'll act like I don't know anything. Just promise me that when you prove them wrong and do something big with your life, you'll find me and Jessica and hang out with us again." "Promise. Are you still going to Notre Dame in the fall?" "Yeah, but you're not going to the University of Dayton, are you?" I froze. I wasn't sure what to say. I know I'm not as good as you are with computers, but you do know that I'm a master hacker, right?" He laughed. "I hacked into the university's list of confirmed students for the fall, and your name wasn't on it. You weren't on any lists at any college that accepted you. So I started thinking about what I would be planning if I were you. And I don't want you to think that I don't trust you, Corey. I just couldn't..." "We can email each other to stay in touch. Whatever you do, don't look back once you leave. You need to stick to buses and cabs. Take alternative routes, even if it forces you to go out of your way. Oh, and don't open that brown paper bag I gave you until you're out of the state." He stood up and gave me a brief hug. "Jessica knows, too, by the way. She's too hurt to say goodbye.
but she understands, and she says she loves you. Oh my God, look at the two of you.
Luann burst through my door with the camera.
I need a picture of my sons. Well, a photo of my foster son and my real son. Both of you stand together. Smile on three. One, two.
Hey, kid. The cab driver snapped me out of my thoughts. Wake up. This is as far as $45 will take you. I looked outside and saw tall stone buildings, but I couldn't make out what any of them were. I had been hopping from bus to bus and cab to cab for days, and I'd lost all sense of location because everywhere I went, it was raining. Thank you. I handed him the money and stepped out of the car. Within seconds, the thin jacket and tattered jeans I was wearing were completely drenched. I had an umbrella in my backpack, but I knew pulling it out now was useless. I walked through what appeared to be a college campus. There was greenery and buildings every few feet, but each building I attempted to get into was locked. I apparently needed an access card to get in, a Harvard University access card. I'd been accepted into Harvard months ago, but I never wrote back to confirm. As soon as I'd read that their top computer science graduate from the past year was a guy who developed a mini-computer, something I'd done when I was 14, I decided that there was nothing they could teach me. I saw a group of students holding the door to a lecture hall open, so I rushed past them. I walked down the hallway, peering into every classroom, cursing when I saw that they were all filled. Once I was at the end of the hall, I slipped inside a dark classroom and breathed a sigh of relief. "Nice of you to join us on time. Have a seat in the back, please." The lights came on and a blonde-haired man in a tweed suit stood up behind a podium. "Any time now, son." The class laughed, and I walked up the steps, taking a seat in the last row. I ignored the itchy feel of damp denim against my skin and looked up at the board. Summer course, Advanced Software 4100. All the students had laptops and state-of-the-art data configuration boards on their desks. All of them looked way older than I was. I guess this is a senior-level course. So, the professor moved the projector screen from the center of the room. We've been deconstructing our hypothetical company, Betalink, and so far we have three people in the running for the best computer: George Hamilton II, Lindsay Franco, and William Dane. Could the three of you come up here and show the class what you've built, please? They took their places up front and explained their computers in the most mundane voices I'd ever heard. It was bad enough that their computers sucked, but their sense of arrogance and know-it-all attitudes were even harder to bear. They have access to the best technology in the world, and this is the best they can come up with? Very impressive, the professor clapped. To everyone else in this room, you have quite the competition if you're going to get an A. Does anyone have any questions for George, Lindsay, or William? No one raised their hand. No one? No one has a question about how they develop their processors? You're just going to let them walk away with the top grades? I can only give out a certain number of A's, you know. There is a very steep curve in this class, and I will be putting it to use. I raised my hand. Yes, you. He pointed to me. What do you want to ask? Those aren't really the best computers, right? You're just using those three as an example to make the rest of us work harder, correct? The room erupted into murmurs. Everybody looked back and forth between me and the professor. No, I'm not, he said. These are indeed the best computers in the class, and seeing as though you didn't bring yours to critique today makes me feel like they're definitely better than whatever you built. But since you seem to think that... George's computer will crash in 6 weeks. I crossed my arms. He's overcompassing the RAM drive with unnecessary wiring. One too many shutdowns, and it'll never turn on again. Lindsay's computer, if you want to call it that, is using all the wrong materials. Unless everyone else in this class is using sticks and stones, a computer with recycled coils and used wiring should never be considered a good computer. Technology isn't up to date enough for eco-computers yet, and William's computer
though impressive to look at, is actually, he pretty much